I appreciate that heartwarming introduction. Jeez. Talk about Southern hospitality, for God's sake. Tom Ivins, an alcoholic. And after this weekend, I feel like I'm missing something if I don't have a mic in front of me. I put in for a pay raise. These dudes are loafing, and they're working me like a dog. It's just been a real good deal, and good to be here. Now, what we're supposed to talk about are the good old days and how to bring them forth and all that kind of stuff. Let me tell you one thing about the did I tell you who I was? You remember who I am? I won't do it anyway. I don't think I did. Tom Ivins, alcoholic, member of the primary, member of the primary purpose group in Pine, North Carolina. And the sobriety date, as you gathered, is back in the First World War, sometime. And tell you one thing about the good old days. Anybody that remembers the good old days with longing and reverence either wasn't there or has a very poor memory. Because I guarantee you, those good old days weren't all that good. And there's some rough, tough stuff. I'll just tell you a couple of war stories, and then I'll tell you what I'd like to bring forward, because there was a lot of good stuff in the old days, too. But I remember the days when you couldn't get an alcoholic into a... The only thing available was a tapering off joint. That was the closest thing to a detox that we had. No such thing as rehab, except in Minnesota, where Bob started one. And the days were lean. And I remember in North Carolina, the first time I ever remember having an alcoholic in a hospital bed by diagnosis as an alcoholic was up in the mountains of North Carolina, a little place called Silva. And I just happened to be in town, and they saw me as a willing participant. And back then, when you put an alcoholic in the room, you had to put a keeper from AA in there with them. Didn't want nurses to have to be wrestling drunks. And so if you put him in, he belonged to you, and you had to look after that person till he got sane or something. I don't know what it was. So they drafted me, and it was just like pulling guard duty. You report for duty, and say, I'm here to relieve you. And so I went in, and the guy met me at the door, and he said, he's just fine, man. You won't have any problem whatsoever. He is just fine. Went into the room, no drunk. Where is this fool? I mean, there's nowhere to go. I mean, the man standing at the door, the windows were about that wide. There's no way he could get out of there. And I said, come on now, you got to be kidding. And so I looked all over the place, under the bed, in the bed, put the ceiling tiles, tried to look, see if he might have gotten up in there. In the bathroom, no drunk. And then I heard a little clatter. They had a wall locker there, metal wall locker, with a clatter in there. And I said, my God. So I opened the door, and he was only slightly confused. He thought he was standing at a urinal, and I said, what, like I couldn't tell, I said, what are you doing in there, clown? And he said, I beg your pardon. Excuse the French, but I said, pardon my ass, get out of that thing, get in that bed. Yeah, but that's what you had to do in those days, deliver me from the return of those good old days. And so I say, your bad memory or weren't there, one or the other. Because those were some grim and rough days. And those days I remember only too well, when we couldn't get an alcoholic care under any conditions. I held an alcoholic in my arms while he died on a 12-step call. I had nowhere to take him. And so the day that treatment came into existence in this country was a happy day in my life. Dream come true. Because I had deeply stored the dream of someday seeing alcoholics treated with dignity and professionalism in a proper setting. I didn't know if I'd ever see those days. But we just started to gradually creep in that direction. And And then some AA members, just enterprising folk that we are, started to open up those little old jitter joint things. And they were, that's all they were, was just tapering off places. But they were at least a start. And then gradually that just started to grow. The good news and the bad news is that there came a time, I don't know exactly when, but you know, if I don't, can't remember what the sobriety date is, I can't remember when treatment started to become a real reality. But it was somewhere around the late 70s and 80s that we started to get some real interest stirred up, and American Medical Association had indicated alcoholism was an illness, and those things had started to fall in place. And treatment came into being. And so it's a mixed blessing, you know, that when treatment emerged, I think there was a ripple of enthusiasm and rejoicing in the fellowship, which rapidly turned into a sort of a tense relationship. And I'll be real straight up with you, that one of the things that happened, particularly in our response to the emergence of treatment, was we didn't handle it very well. I'll give you an example. In my hometown, a treatment center was opened, and normally, you want CPC, the Cooperation Professional Community, is the one that takes the initiative and goes to establish good cooperative relationships. I'm sorry to admit it, but the treatment management staff, before they ever opened, asked us to meet with them. And so we met with them. And we started mapping plans for how we would carry the message there, what kind of program we would do, what kind of visiting we would do that would not be disruptive to the facility. And when the first patient showed up, we were ready. We were prepared. And that's what Cooperation Professional Committee ought to do, is to coordinate so we can work together and not polar opposites. And so it was a good beginning. And what happened in the result of it, and what I'd really love to see us, I don't know if we'll ever do it, I'd like for us to see, to recapture one of the things that got lost in the emergence of treatment, and more particularly in our response to it. Because when we started to respond to it, we reacted more than responded. And what we started doing was having sort of angry feelings at treatment for doing our work, which we did as a service, and they're doing it for pay. And there was a lot of grumbling and grousing in the ranks about that. And what we did was sort of backed off into our tent and got a little irritated about the whole deal. And it was as if, to illustrate, as if we're used to alcoholics coming in that door. When treatment came up, they started coming in that door. And we didn't like it. We wanted to come in that door. Yeah. And so what happened, we just sort of backed off. And we stopped doing our aggressive outreach to get hold of alcoholics. We just stopped doing it. Now, it wasn't announced and done as a declaration, but we just gradually pulled back and started to lose something. One of the things that we lost essentially, I won't ask the question here, but one of the things that we started to lose pretty abruptly, but still with some gradualism, was this thing of one alcoholic reaching out to another. Yeah, you know, we started to lose that. You know, we started to get so that alcoholics started coming into AA from divergent places, most of which had nothing to do with a real connection to another alcoholic reaching out and helping to bridge that gap between the two. And that started to wane and to go away. And so it would be a safe bet. Now, obviously, don't know everybody's history here, but it would be a safe bet today to say that in this group, which is probably an above-average group of folks who are spending a Saturday night down in wherever we are, Georgia, and it'd be a pretty safe bet to say that at least 75 or 80% of this group has never experienced a 12-step call, either as provider or consumer. It's almost a lost art. You know, you still get a little bit of it. I think I've had three this year. All three came from ministers of churches. You never know where they're going to come from. But we started to stop that. And so where people were getting a spiritual kind of connection to AA by one alcoholic reaching out to another, just like Bill did to Bob, instead of getting that, what we started getting was clinical referrals. and aftercare plans and all kinds of ways to sort of regiment the process rather than that spiritual connection. And the loser in that is both of us. It's both of us. And so it was a significant juncture. And I'll just give you one other illustration and then say that what I'd like to see us, I don't know if we'll ever do it, but I'd love to see us rekindle that energy to reach out and meet alcoholics where they are. I don't care what it is, whether it's treatment or jail or the post office floor. I don't care where it is. I want to see us reach out to that. And one other illustration is that I think you can kind of get the gist of what I'm talking about. If you think about, everybody here familiar with Roland Hazard? Okay, well, then I'll tell you who he is. The majority didn't answer, so Roland Hazard was a guy that fished a guy named Ebbie Thatcher out of court in Vermont, and the judge was getting ready to send Ebbie to jail for the umpteenth time, and some people not from AA, one of them was a guy named Roland Hazard, and Roland and a couple of other people went to the court and said, don't send him to jail, give him to us. Well, my God, if you ever saw, I met Ebbie. He was not a handsome beast, I tell you that. That sucker didn't need to show his credentials to say he was an alcoholic. I mean, you could tell that a block away. That guy was a... Anyway, the judge said, take him, for God's sake, take him. Well, nobody knew that was what was going to happen, but that was started the ball rolling that became Alcoholics Anonymous. And so listen to what's written into that. You know, here are three guys who walk into a court and say, don't sentence him, don't give him a chance, give us a chance with him. And now it's not a happy ending with Roland died sober. Ebbie had lots of trouble. But he stayed sober long enough to carry the message to Bill Wilson. And the point is, if you think about that experience of what happened in that court, where these people reached out to him, that is a very spiritual action, very spiritual action. And nobody could deny it. And now, what do we do with people who go into court? Suppose there's any spiritual experience involved in that? It's almost like we're processing chickens in a production thing, where people go in there and it's just sort of a ritualistic system where it's almost like running a production line, where we've got people that go through a standard process that's legal, probably humane, but in terms of a human touch, what does a guy feel connected to? And so we wind up with people, rather than responding to the human touch and the spiritual message, what we wind up with is people with little pieces of paper coming in, trying to get one of us to be patient enough to sign the dumb thing. Well, that's a lousy introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what I'd like to see us bring forward would be that thing that we dropped, recognizing that the most powerful thing in the world that we offer is one alcoholic reaching out to another. And I'd like to see us do that. I'll just give you one suggestion, and then I think I'm about to run out of time. I always run out of time. I think fast, talk slow. Let me tell you, if you want to see those old days come back, if you catch a vision of that, let me tell you how you can do it. And I'll give you one other example, then I'll tell you the homework. I was over to detox one day at the hospital, and went in, and there were no patients. Well, now that's unusual. And so I'm standing there kibitzing with a nurse and said, where are the drunks? And they said, you don't have any. And there was a woman I didn't know who happened to be the director of the behavioral section of the. That means everybody that's got a screw loose or a cork loose or whatever, anybody that's running amok, it goes into that section, including alcoholics. And so she was the director of that. And I said, well, I am sure glad to meet you. I said, what have we done, cured alcoholism in this area? She said, oh, no, nothing like that. I said, well, why aren't there any patients here? She said, it's a simple thing, it's money. No money, no detox. No insurance, no detox. There's a move back toward the days of yesteryear we don't want to see. But that's what was there. And I said, you know, that's too bad. I said, what happens to people who come here to go into detox? And she said, well, they come into the emergency room and they go to the intake person, not the triage person, but the intake person, and they say they want to go to detox. And the intake person says, do you have funds or insurance? And all too often the person will say no. And the intake person will say, I'm sorry, we can't admit you. And it's not because they're mean-spirited or mean-hearted. They can't do it. They cannot handle that kind of case. And I said, well, what happens to those who get turned back? And she looked kind of troubled for a minute, and she said, you know, I don't know. Now, it'd be real easy for me to draw up in pride and arrogance and say, well, you should know. You're the director of this unit. Well, I'm the oldest active member in my state. I'm the most active member in that area. I didn't know. See what I'm talking about? Yeah, we got alcoholics hitting the wall and standing there mystified, and an intake person sitting at a desk equally mystified. What a great opportunity. If you want to see the good old days, take a look in your community. I don't care where it is. Take a look at your community where alcoholics hit the wall. And it's 100 different kinds that I just gave, the court, you know, the driver's license agency, social services. I just told you my last three 12-step calls came from ministers. That's where people go when they don't have money. And so places where alcoholics are in crisis are wonderful places to set up that process, very humane spiritual process, where if we simply took the time to go to that hospital or that minister or whoever, and that's what CPC's for, and say, what do you guys do? We'd like to help. And just simply equip them with some information about how they can contact us and get a real human being to respond to that situation. That's how the old days will come back. It won't be because of resurrecting old relics like me and trying to pump life into them. It'll be a matter of starting to get back to the spiritual roots from which we came. So that's the one thing I'd like, one of many things I'd like to pull forward, but that's certainly one. When you take the spiritual value out of Alcoholics Anonymous, you take the heart out of it. And so I think that's a vitally important thing, and I hope that you'll consider that homework and go back and just don't worry about the world, just worry about your community, the alcoholics who are hitting it in your town, and see if it's a place where you can intervene. And you'll see what the old days were like. Thanks.
Good evening. I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. Sober through the grace of God in AA since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. I'm a substitute wise man. You would have ordinarily had Clancy up here, and I'm filling in. And the first idea I heard of, oh, by the way, I have one suggestion for the committee. I think you ought to urine test the voice of the conference. There ought to be some sort of standard. I think that would do that. I have one other that this ritual where we have the old timers give the books to the newcomers, which I think is terrific. I hope in addition to that, that next year we'd have those two young women with a year and 2 days part of the ceremony giving it to with the old timers. But I just think it would be wonderful to start bringing people who got sober at the same time the conference started, and that would be a little tradition we could have. When this was first suggested, they were talking about what kind of gift would you give someone who was coming into Alcoholics Anonymous? What one thing would you like? And then later Dick said it's just sharing our general wisdom. And when I thought about all the gifts that I I gave, and I guess because I presented on the sixth and the seventh step, the gift I would have recommended for myself or anybody else was humility. Because I think that that would be a frame of mind and a spiritual condition that would allow us to be teachable, to be guided, to be open, to not be appalled that difficult things were happening to us. Our society and world is a different place today. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1967, I think the world supported recovery. As you look around the world today, when they're sending you credit, it's changed a little bit, but they were sending you credit cards in the mail for $5,000, when you could get on your computer and buy drugs and gamble and get as much sex as you want and never leave your bedroom, I'm sure I would have said no thank you, but just in the off chance of my early sobriety that whatever happened to Bob, he died in his bedroom, he never, I think he starved to death. But there's a sense of entitlement in our society today. There is a secularism in our society today. The wind is blowing about 60 miles an hour. For those of us that are in the program, if you're wondering sometimes why, if you feel like you're drifting away from the core of spiritual principles, just, I mean, there's a big wind blowing out there. I mean, you have to, in order just to maintain your spiritual condition, you really have to be somewhat serious about it, because there just is no other place. Almost everything else is calling us to the, I mean, the rest of the message that we get from the world is you're not okay. Every movie, every advertisement, every magazine that you pick up says you're not okay. You need these sunglasses, this outfit. You need a better body. You need a younger woman. You need a bigger house. You need more money. You need a faster horse. It is just, and if you aren't centered, I mean, the message is that you, the answer is external. I mean, and it is everywhere. There are very few places where you're getting the core message that the answer is internal. A lot of the young people I see today, when they come into Alcoholics Anonymous, as troubled as they are, one of the troubles they have is they feel like they're giving something up. The people who came earlier in Alcoholics Anonymous, in the quote, the good old days, were felt like they were being let out of jail. I mean, they found a solution. And it's a sense of entitlement that they, you know, that if they quit too early or they, you know, they and the idea of what they want, which is the biggest issue. I'm a materialist and I struggle and fight. I am a wanting machine. I mean, if you want to know what's wrong with me, I mean, in every area when it has eating or smoking or money, or I'm a wanting machine. You put me in front of it, I want it. And it has been the most difficult thing for me just to say to yourself, so what? I mean, my wife is an adult. I mean, it is just, I mean, you know, she may want something, but it doesn't matter to her as much as it matters to me. I mean, I this is a painful thing for me when I actually want something and I have to turn myself down, you know? I mean, it's just, I mean, what kind of nonsense is that? But I mean, that's real. I mean, that's real in my life. If I were trying to tell someone when they came into Alcoholics Anonymous what to do is get a guide. My sponsor was a hunter. I never hunted until I had a mentor, a wonderful man by the name of Bob White in Texas, and we built a home in Texas, and when I went to Texas, I started hunting. If you don't hunt, they think you're a latent homosexual. And I, and I went on this wonderful hunting trip with my sponsor out, and we paid thousands of dollars, you know, $6,000-$7,000 to go to this 600,000-acre ranch in New Mexico and Colorado to hunt elk. If you pay $6,000 or $7,000 to go hunt elk, you'd like to find one. If there are 600,000 acres of property, it would help to know where they are. And if you are somewhat competitive and you want maybe the first elk or the largest elk, if you're the type of person that thinks like that, that self-centeredness and ego-based, you'd want the best guide. You'd want the guy that would put you on the most animals, to give you the best choices, to help you with the calculations and shooting and that sort of thing. And when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're dealing with altering your life. We have a fatal disease, and we have an answer for that disease. We have hundreds and hundreds of people who understand your disease if you're a new person coming in the room, or if you're a person who has recently had serious relapse and had trouble. We have the answer for that. But we have trouble availing ourselves of this. Some of us don't develop relationships easily. Some of us don't maintain relationships easily. Get a guide. Get a man or a woman who you can share your life with, who you can follow around, even if you don't at first like this person. You don't have to have as much in common with the person. I think in some ways it is interesting that in many cases I think opposites attract. I think sometimes the doctor that gets the plumber is a more powerful relationship because they see the similarity of the answer in the disparity of the profession and circumstances. You are going to have to, if you're going to spend a lifetime in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to have to meet some problems. You are going to have to meet the disappointments that when your sponsor turns out to be human. When you first come in and you expect that you want this person to have all your answers, and you find out that he's having some trouble at home with his wife, or that his business is failing, or whatever it is. Those are the sorts of things that all of us have to meet in life. And it isn't a symptom that you have to discard this person. It is a symptom that you have to enlarge the relationship. And if you can meet the problems that you're going to have, when you walk into a group and you think the group's wonderful and then something happens to you within the group and you feel like you are spurned in the group, and this is what happened. There are little cliques and there are people that you're going to get your feelings hurt. You're going to feel like you're being shuffled aside and all this sort of thing. Don't let that spoil your Alcoholics Anonymous experience. We are a flawed, curious group of people. I think it is amazing that we get fully dressed and make it to the meetings on time. But if I were standing up here and I had a cure for AIDS, and you were people who were afflicted with HIV virus, and I said, I have a cure, who's interested? I think we'd have a pretty good show of hands. Hey, but it's difficult. You got to go to 3, 4, 5, 6 meetings a week. They'll make your life better. They'll straighten out most of the issues that you have. You will have joy and an experience and a fellowship that you've been unable to experience for an awful long time. So it's going to be hard. I don't think any of the hands will go down. But you have to find a guide. You have to find someone who will care for you and help you through this process. But there's hundreds of people who are standing ready to do that. And yet, for some strange reason, we fight the diagnosis. We don't want to have the disease. We don't want to have the solution. And it is a fatal disease that afflicts, it's in some ways with a chronic illness, there's some real similarities between it and diabetes and it and AIDS and it and some of the other chronic diseases that we have. And it really is just destroys families. And I would want you to have the very best chance that you would have. And we have a book that has the instructions and the guide to take us through the process of finding the power that will restore us to sanity. And it's been proven for 75 years that book works. And we're not interested if you believe it. I just read a book recently about the New Christianity. And they compared the New Christianity and the Old Christianity. And they said the Old Christianity, in order to be a good Christian, there were certain dogmatic beliefs that you had, there are certain things you had to believe to be a good guy or gal. today the new faith isn't quite as interested in that. It's interested in the people in the churches finding the spiritual principles to put them in action in their lives to improve their lives. And that's what I think we have at the best of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's nice if you believe certain things and that we share those beliefs, but what's more important is that you gain access to the spiritual principles and put them in your life and start to get the results that our book promises. And you don't even have to do it very well. But if your heart's okay, and it is as much a matter of the heart as it is a matter of the head. And if you come in and you join us, and you're going to start a conversation about your life, you're going to start a conversation about your God, you're going to start a conversation about your illness, and you're going to start a conversation about what the solution to your illness is. I've been in that conversation for 42 years. I've had it at hundreds of meetings. Someone once said to me that you can't learn anything you do not already know. You ever sat in a meeting and someone says something that is so profound, your head doesn't go, "Oh yeah, I agree. Isn't that interesting?" Your soul just goes, "Oh yeah." And you just know that it's so. You just know that it's so. You have a knower that I think is what we speak to in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I drew a circle and the circle's everything in that circle was everything there was to know, and then took a slice of pie out of the circle and said, in that slice of pie is what you know. The next slice of pie is what you don't know. The entire rest of the pie is what you don't know and don't know you don't know. Almost everything that I have learned of meaning in Alcoholics Anonymous has come from the part of the pie that I did not know and did not know I did not know. And you have spoon-fed it to me, meeting by meeting, conversation by conversation, cup of coffee by cup of coffee, 12-step by 12-step. And it always shows up at the time that I need it. It doesn't show, you know, most of us have trouble in life because we want an answer for something that's going to happen in the future. The answer comes when we are presented with the circumstance that we are concerned about. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, and in life as we go through the program, because that's when it becomes a piece of business, not a conjecture, not a worry. And most of us are hurling ourselves from our past, which we don't like, towards some sort of magic salvation in the future, and we spend very little time in the moment. But if we would stay in the moment, when a circumstance and situation presents itself to us, in the moment, we're not busy. In the moment, our minds are not these hurried machines. Our minds are these hurried, horrible gerbil tracks when we are concerned with the past and the future. But when we're in the moment, when we're really in this conversation, in these magic moments and meetings, there's a peace, there's a quiet right now in this room, and we're all okay. As we go through our day in that space, God and the universe will give us what we need in the moment, to deal with in the moment. What we do in Alcoholics Anonymous for each other is we come into a newcomer comes into a room, and we see something for the newcomer that that person often cannot see for themselves. We hold a promise for that person that they don't know about, and we hold it for them until they can start to see it. And they come in, and in that room is a collective consciousness. There's 30 minds, 30 hearts, 30 souls in that room. And to some extent, the newcomer checks their mind at the door. And they bring their damp log to the bonfire of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that bonfire, we start to dry out their log. And somewhere along the line, their pilot light gets relit. I think we do that better than anybody else around. I think the magic in Alcoholics Anonymous of the profound, strong, workable spiritual program that we have, combined with the common sense and the bullshit meter that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. We do. There's a sense that we understand, as long as you're speaking from your heart, it's just fine with us. But we really do kind of know when something isn't genuine. We just have a sense of it in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a gift. That is. So mostly, we have pretty straight conversations that are going on in AA. And if we would have the grace to allow ourselves to stay in that space, to find a guide, to get into the book and develop an affection for the book, to allow ourselves, even after we've been sober 5 or 10 or 15 years, to re-energize ourselves and maybe go back through the steps with a seriousness that we haven't been able to conjure for a while, and to get a piece of business to work on our lives rather than a complaint. And when you have a piece of business, you're more in the game than when you've got a complaint. And because the magic is still here. The power is still here. The power that transforms, doesn't improve, doesn't correct, it transforms. It is not linear. It is transformational. It takes us from a place and transports us through time and space, and suddenly, and the book is full of examples where it talks about all of a sudden, at once, we see levels of improvement and change that are unexplainable for each other. And that is the miracle that we get to watch all the time. And that's like the story of Christmas. That's why I like this time of year. It is, I think, Tom Ivester's story, like all our stories to some extent, is the story of Christmas. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm honored to be amongst my friends here tonight. And thanks, Dick, Carol, and I've had a wonderful time. I was going to just thinking back on Tom made me think of the good old days. I also had a sponsor for over 42 years, like Bob does. And it was a wonderful event. And when I came in, there was one feature in AA that was a blessed event that is gone now. And that event was that when you called, you got the inner group, and they sent someone to get you. You didn't go to a meeting direct. And that man became, or woman became, your sponsor. So your sponsor knocks on the door and comes in and takes over. And before he leaves, your whole family's been briefed about what AA is. And what the wife has any questions, you can call my wife. I mean, if so much was accomplished in the first hour that sometimes today takes about 6 months to get the family hearing the same word, because the way it is now, the alcoholic goes home and tells the family what goes on in AA. They want me to taper off, and, you know. And then he took me to whatever meeting it was that night. That was one of his groups that he went to all the time. And as he came in the door, he went, "This is Sandy. He's brand new. He's going to be joining our group. This is Ralph. This is da, 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 da." It's all over. I didn't have to go up and introduce myself to anyone. So it really was a very nice arrangement. And I just jogged my memory to see what else was different then. Not better, just different. And the first one was that when you said your name, nobody said hi. You just said, "Hi, I'm Sandy, I'm an alcoholic," and then you started your talk. And that, I don't know where it came from. I've always said it came from California. I blame California for every damn thing. And all of a sudden, they're shouting back at people up in Washington, D.C. And I'm looking around, and people are going, "Hi, hi," and I'm going, "Gee whiz." So then I got in the spirit of it. "Hi, hi, Joe, hi, you know." And about 6 months later, I was up in Boston, and the "hi" hadn't got up there yet. And a guy said, "Hi, I'm Ralph, the speaker." And I went, "Hi, Ralph." And I was the only one in the room yelling, "Hi, Ralph." So I said, "It's on its way, so you guys watch out." And then the only thing we read was the preamble. And then these readings started showing up from California, I think. And it took 10 minutes before you got to the meeting. So you see how we see it different. And I'm going, "When will you get this stuff over with so we can get to the meeting?" And then we didn't hold hands during the Lord's Prayer. And then that showed up, and I think it came from California. I had about 5 years, and the guy next to me grabbed my hand. And I wondered, what is going on? Does he find me attractive? So anyway, those are very minor things. But they bring back some memories that are very pleasant. If I were to tell you what I've gotten out of AA in 44 years, obviously sobriety, my family, and I have 6 kids and 15 grandchildren. And this may sound strange, but I don't feel any closer to my family than I do to you or the waitress in the restaurant. We're all the same. And my kids really are excited when I call or come home, but I don't attend everything. But I'm there, and they call me all the time for advice, and they just think I'm great. And if you were to ask him, "Well, is he a good father?" "Yeah, well, why is he a good father?" And he says, "He's just out doing what he's supposed to." And you see, it's sort of a non-family connection in a traditional way, but it shows that if we are, in fact, doing what God is asking us to do, it takes care of everything. It just takes care of everything. What was one other thing? My career. We generally talk about work. And I had a mixed career, and I was in the Marine Corps, and I didn't retire. I got thrown out, but I had a lot of fun flying airplanes and had a few compliments and a lot of disappointment in terms of superior people, which I feel bad about. But then in sobriety, I got some good jobs, and I up in Washington, D.C., and I got certain compliments for writing and speeches and getting things done and so on down. But the biggest compliment I ever got, and I'll never forget it, I had worked at this little government agency for about 10 years. And I did a good job writing, so the trade association wanted to hire me away at a higher salary, and I was happy to do that. And I'd been in this little group, it was in the general counsel's office, and there was about 4 or 5 lawyers and some legal assistants, et cetera. So they had a little goodbye party, and off I went, only about 10 blocks away. So it afforded me the opportunity every 6 months or so to come back and get together with my old buddies and have lunch. God, this story just, anyway. I'd been gone about 2 years, and I called these guys up, and there was probably five of us, and we went to lunch, and we were sitting there, and about 20 minutes into the lunch, the assistant general counsel, Jim, he just put his fork down, and he says, "I'll tell you one thing, it stopped being fun to work here the day Sandy left." That's the biggest compliment I've ever gotten, in the workplace. It made me feel great. And the reason they were so happy that I brought that was because I brought it from here. I brought the exact energy that is infused in us in here out into our regular life. And when you bring that energy into a restaurant or a dry cleaners or wherever, the people are so glad when you come in to pick up your clothes. Oh, here she comes. I always get a smile and I feel so good. And just there's something about the road. That is an incredible gift that we get out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, anything I say is just my opinion. And if it's at odds with your sponsor or your home group, then you listen to your sponsor and your home group and not this weird guy that's standing up here. The most important gift that I got was God. That's the most important gift that I got. And that is the center of my life. And I got it right here in AA. And I got it by precisely being guided through the 12 steps just as they're written in order to achieve the one result that we're supposed to get, which is a spiritual awakening and a conscious contact with our own Creator. This, to me, is the crowning jewel of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the highest calling any person can have is to show another person how to have that awakening. And I agree with Bob that some of this is being diminished, and it's because our society has changed, so the influx that we're getting in has an influence on how strongly we stay committed to this single purpose. And a girl came to the AA club I go to, and she graduated from Harvard about 4 or 5 years ago, got an MBA, very brilliant. And she was having a terrible problem with the God part of Alcoholics Anonymous, because in her class, if you ever use that word around your classmates, you got ridiculed. And she didn't want the word getting back that she even was saying the word or listening to the word, lest her classmates find out and whatever they're going to do to her for coming to AA and finding this word. Now, that's detrimental to staying alive in Alcoholics Anonymous, since that's the only possible thing that can keep us alive. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is we have to resist the pressures of the current society to cause the world to adjust to the individual. To cause the world to adjust to the individual. When I came in, there was lots of parts of the program I didn't like. I mean, I took a look at this stuff, and there's a lot of stuff. I didn't like the not drinking part. I didn't like it at all. Now, today, they wouldn't say, I don't like the not drinking part. They would say, I'm offended by the not drinking part. I'm offended by the fourth step inventory. It's an invasion of my privacy. I'm offended that I have to go make amends. It's embarrassing. It's going to demean me. I don't want to subject myself to that. I am offended by a lot of this stuff in here. And if we wanted to be cooperative, we might hold a group conscience. Harry's offended by our fourth step procedure. Perhaps we could find a way of getting him through it in a more harmonious way. We could get a typical fourth step, sort of a generic fourth step, and read it to Harry and say, is yours similar to this? And we would let him nod. He wouldn't have to utter the word yes, just a nod. We'll give him a pass on the fourth step. So what would we be doing? We'd be killing him. That's what we'd be doing. We'd be signing his death warrant. Because the purpose of spirituality is to show us how to adjust to the real world rather than demanding that the real world adjusts to us. So when someone's offended by the Lord's Prayer and you cave in, you're signing their death warrant. You're teaching them that in here, whatever they don't like, we will get rid of. And we're compromising ourselves on some stupid principle that someone is offended by something. In the old days, it was, I don't like it. And we can't afford this type of erosion. A little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there, and pretty soon we'll be trying to get sober by hanging around. And even if you stay sober, as Tom was talking about, you'll die of the disease of alcoholism sober. We have a guarantee of happiness beyond our wildest dream. The promises, which include the awakening, always materialize. Now, how about that? Does it say sometimes? Always materialize if we work for them. But they can't happen without the power behind everything. This cannot be manufactured out of human power. There's no alternative way to creating the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just ask you all to preserve the integrity for all of us. Thanks.